colleagues. I am delighted to have long inspired my work and that I'm intrigued about to do with how the larger patterns and forces outlined so eloquently by Susan get produced, reproduced and contested in ourselves and come to form the nature of our location, position and identity. And Valerie is going to, I think, take some of that forward for us in terms of her topic today, which is neoliberalism, working class subjects and higher education. I'm delighted to welcome her.
Thank you very much, Valerie, and thank you, Louise, too. It's very, very interesting to be here and also to follow Susan's fabulous talk, because the things that I'm going to be talking about in some ways really connect with that globalized agenda. I'm going to be talking particularly in the context of the British government agenda of opening up higher education, the widening participation agenda, which attempts to talk about the expansion of higher education to working class children in particular, but in the context of neoliberalism and the marketization that Susan was talking about. So in the literature that I've been looking at recently, the government focuses on the qualities of those not participating, particularly disaffection and aspiration. And so I want to think about that in the context of neoliberalism, because it's very interesting that what they're doing is focusing on qualities of those who are to enter higher education, the qualities that they themselves are supposed to possess, like, or not possess rather, disaffection, they're not affected and they don't have any aspiration, those being problems. So I want to think about that in terms of a neoliberal agenda which does suggest that qualities of the subject are themselves central to how regulation, governmentality works. So, I mean, I'm sure you all know this, but just to recap it, that of course what's involved in neoliberal modes of regulation is ideas like freedom, choice, the knowledge economy, as Susan told us, involves the idea that lifelong learning replaces jobs for life, which of course is just as well because there aren't going to be any jobs. And in particular we can think about Nicholas Rose's work following Foucault on the idea that freedom is something that's produced. So in the context of governmentality in the market, freedom is something by which we govern ourselves. Modes of self-governance is the kind of phrase that Nicholas Rose uses. So I wanted to just begin by giving you some examples. These examples come from students and workers in a study that I did in Sydney in Australia. And I want you to meet one young woman. She's 18 and she's at university and she says that she can be anything she wants to be. Wow, fantastic, anything she wants to be. But the problem is she's got so much choice that she can't decide what she wants to be. So she interprets that as a problem of being indecisive. So the problem then is to, as it were, deal with this indecisiveness, not the bewildering sense of this apparent choice which confronts her and how that's built into a mode of regulation, but the sense that she has a problem and that problem needs to be solved. Now I see that idea as quite central to how the governmentality of neoliberalism actually operates. But just let me give you a couple more examples, which are from workers of different ages, who also cohere around this idea that what you are and how you form yourself is central to what you have to be as a worker. So Sophia is a worker in telesales, and what she sells is bottled water. But she talks at an interview about how she identifies with bottled water. No, seriously. Because she says bottled water is good for you. The body's made up of a high percentage of water, and she's, since she's drunk lots of water, she's really understood the benefits. And it's as though by this kind of really strong identification with the product, she almost becomes the water she's selling. And she says she has the personality to sell. And so I was very interested in this example precisely because it seems to suggest that she recognizes something about the necessity in this kind of work to embody both a personality to sell, certain kinds of psychological characteristics, but also this very complex embodiment of the product itself. But if we go to an older worker who I call John, John is having real difficulties. John was a manual worker who's made redundant, and he keeps being sent on courses by Centrelink, the unemployment agency, or the employment agency, I should say, yes, to become a contract cleaner. And he says, well, you know, he's willing to clean. He's quite willing to clean. But the problem is that on these courses, they seem to want him to be motivated. They seem to want him to say that he wants to clean. But he doesn't want to clean. He's willing to clean. And consequently, in his terms, he never gets work because he's not displaying this sense of the personality and the motivation that's demanded of the neoliberal worker. In fact, he thinks that the worker should have phlegmatism and commitment, but phlegmatism and commitment are not necessarily the characteristics demanded of the neoliberal worker. So the reason I'm giving you those examples really is to show how the government of neoliberalism sets up the idea of a subject who can choose, who has a certain amount of freedom, and who has to have certain kinds of psychological characteristics which have to be continuously worked on through lifelong learning and therefore through higher education, and the need to get students into a higher education which will prepare them for this labour market. However, I don't know whether any of you read, I thought, a very interesting article in Sunday's Observer magazine about Greek students and Greek protests and anarchist students. Did anybody read it? Yeah, some people did. I mean, you know, I meant to bring the quote with me. There's a fabulous quote from one of the participants in the protest in Greece who starts to question freedom. She calls freedom a sham and this freedom that we've been sold. And it struck me, well, it's been striking me for a little while now, ever since the recession started to grip, that this is the first moment for ages at which one can actually question the possibility that neoliberalism might not be this kind of overwhelming, impossible to imagine things differently project, really, that there is a sense that, of course, it isn't working, that it depends on a particular kinds of economy, it depends on the development of service and communications and IT sectors, and of course if those jobs aren't there then it starts to fall apart. And you know, what does this government agenda then mean in that context? And even then, of course what we find out if we pay attention to government documents is that this so-called expansion of higher education has not been the expansion that some might have wanted. It has widened participation, but it's widened participation largely, according to the Cabinet Office, of middle class, which I think you know, fits what Susan was telling us earlier about other countries, that here the Cabinet Office says that largely the expansion has been the expansion in middle class take-up of higher education, which I think also relates to an expansion, a gendered expansion of middle class take-up of higher education. So despite the fact that we've moved from a context in which when I went to university there was about 12% of 18-year-olds went on to higher education, and it's now, what, nearer 50? I'm not sure of the exact 46. Nevertheless, actually, again, according to government figures in their latest white paper, there is less social mobility than there was. So they cite research which shows that there was, let me get this right, those born in 1958 in Britain had a higher chance of social mobility than those born in 1970. And that there's a general recognition that social mobility has not increased. Let's not say it's gone down, because I think it's unclear from the research I've looked at, but it's certainly not increased. So here we've got this widening participation agenda. As Louisa told us, we've got 46%, but we haven't got an increase in social mobility, and yet we're supposed to have the preparation for a knowledge economy and a sense of freedom and choice. So it actually, for me, when I started to read about those figures, really made me think differently about the ubiquity, actually, of neoliberalism, not as a mode of governance, which of course is being, you know, pushed mightily, but the complexities of neoliberalism as a way of talking about the experience of particularly working class children. And I think what first made me start to think about and question this was some work I've been doing in South Wales, which I'm going to come back to a little later in the talk, but I've been working in a community which a small town which had a steelworks that was the major employer in the town, and the steelworks closed in 2002. And I've done a couple of projects working with ex-steelworkers and other people in the town, and as part of that we interviewed some young men, unemployed young men, and as I'm going to talk about later, there was a whole set of issues about what kind of employment they wanted. But what comes up in our study is if you look at the interviews that we did, nobody really, over the age of about 24 anyway, uses aspirational discourse. Nobody. But we've done this Australian study, which I took the three case studies from, and there's loads of aspirational discourse in it. You know, a sense that you've got to do things that you want to be. One young man says, a cross between Liza Minnelli and Richard Branson. Which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah, it's more quiet.
Another guy says that he wants to run a nightclub. He wants to be as wealthy as his millionaire boss. He wants to have his girlfriend who's really good to be front of house, and she's going to get all these celebrities in, and he's going to be back of house, and it's just, you know, it's going to be rocking. It's just going to be absolutely fantastic place. There's a lot of this kind of talk amongst the inhabitants of this town. And I was working with a researcher in Sydney, and we were looking at this, and he wouldn't believe me, actually, at first. And then we looked again at the data, and no, there isn't any. And it made me think more carefully about how this neoliberal agenda works, because when I thought more carefully about the history of this community in Wales, it's a community that's had steel production since 1789, well, iron steel production, I should say, since 1789, and has built, it's a community which has been built on hardship. The survival are in quite difficult conditions, really, endlessly difficult conditions. A community with a great history of mutual support. The numbers of people that said that the town was like a family was extraordinary. And the sense that people helped each other, that there was a sense of solidarity and pride in manufacture, pride in doing a good job, very strong gender division of labour, and a sense of support. Now, of course, in that, as soon as I thought about this, I thought, why hadn't I seen this before? Of course, what there was a sense of working class help and solidarity. In that context, aspiration doesn't make any sense. Aspiration is an individualized phenomenon. It means that you want to be better than somebody else. This community didn't get where it was through people wanting to be better than each other, in my opinion, anyway. That's just my sense. I'm not saying anybody told me this, but that's the sense I was trying to make of this data. That actually, and the kind of sense that people had that they wanted to stay in the town, they didn't want to move, they weren't going to get on their bikes to go somewhere else and find work. They didn't even want to go to the next valley. They wanted to stay where they were and make do, because that's where they knew people. That's where the family is. And actually what it did was to make me think again about that sense that we get in Nicholas Rose's interpretation of Foucault's work on liberalism, that actually there's this simple relationship between the state, between governance and the subject, as though actually all that we take on simply these modes of governance which tell us how we are to be, that we can choose, that we are free, that we have lifelong learning, as though we were rather one-dimensional subjects. And in fact, it doesn't take account of the specificities of particular histories, cultures, geographies, and so forth, and therefore suggests that modes of experience and subjectivity are much more complex than this. And it's that complexity I just want to talk a little bit about. So I'm going to give some examples from research that I've done over the years on working class and middle class girls and young women, and working class young men. And I want to begin with this, the data I'm going to talk about is taken from a study that was conducted by Helen, Lucy, June, Melody and myself. It started off as a project looking at 15 middle class, 15 working class mothers and their daughters born in 1974-75. It was a project that was undertaken by Barbara Tizard and Martin Hughes, but they very kindly allowed us to look at the data. And then we followed the young women, the girls then, up at 10 and at 21. One of the things that Tizard and Hughes make a lot of is the idea that there are things they call sensitive mothers, that sensitive mothering is something that is an emotion, a sense that the mother is sensitive to her daughter's needs, has some kind of emotional sensitivity, and this would also be a sensitivity to meaning. Now, although they don't actually say that this will be predictive of entry into higher education, they do make a big thing of it, that in a sense they imply that it has a certain predictive quality in relation to educational attainment. And it's noticeable that some of the working class mothers in particular are described by them as insensitive or not as sensitive. Well, if you've ever read the book that Helen, Lucy and I wrote about this, called Democracy in the Kitchen, we'll see that we weren't terribly happy with this idea. But what I want to think about here is that by the time we get to 21, all of the 15 working class girls, except for one who's become a New Age traveller, have gone to university. Three of the working class girls go to university, and not one of them straightforwardly at 18, not one. But all three have insensitive mothers. They're the only three that go. So, I mean, it's like this staggering counter-prediction, and again made us look really carefully at what is it that produces the possibility of only these three young women going on to higher education. What is it that happens at home that actually, in what Tizard and Hughes picked out as insensitivity, what does it do? Is it doing something? And it led us to suggest that you can't actually read off from middle class child rearing and educational strategies what is needed for working class students to get onto higher education. That was, I think, the strongest thing that I would possibly say, that you cannot read it off, and that there's been a tradition, a long tradition in this country, of assuming that middle class developmental pathways are the norm to which those others have to aspire. Well, it's not right, and I discovered recently also that Anne Phoenix has written something similar about black and ethnic minority families. So the middle class mothers in the study at four, they produced, well, one of the things they validated was rational argument. And to cut a long story short, the girls at four, well, it was very noticeable because they could, the middle class girls were often able to get their own way if they could produce an argument. Good performance as they go through as they grow up and go into higher education. Good education performance is a norm, it's not anything to actually comment on. You know, one young woman comes home, tells her mum that she's got, I think it was 9 grade A's at GCSE and a C at 1C, and her mum's only comment is pity about the C. In other words, what's expected is good performance. It's not to be mentioned, it's not to be celebrated, it's just an expectation. And alongside it, massive amounts of anxiety. Huge amounts of anxiety actually amongst the middle class young women. So in some ways I think that this fits the increased sense of increased take up of higher education by middle class young women, that actually what we have is a sense of a group of women increasingly, of course, after feminism, fitted for and made ready for aspiration, to a sense that they can do it, they're expected to do it, that there's no question about it. And it's also evident, at 21 we not only interviewed these young women and their families, but we got to make video diaries. And one of the things that comes out in the video diaries is that the middle class young women in particular present themselves to the camera as Bev Skeggs' terms, Bev Skeggs is a sociologist who's done a lot of work on class and gender, as having value. She says that a possessive individual is defined by the ability to accrue value, by having a proprietorial relation to their own bodies. And actually what you see in these video diaries is young women doing pieces to camera in which it's taken as obvious that the viewer will find their lives interesting. I would say that's the main sense of it. In contrast to that, you've got young working class women who wipe their diaries. You know, they record something and then they wipe it out because they think it just looks too awful. Or a young woman who sits on her bed and says, well, that's it. That's me. That's it. That's me. There are these little, and it's quite painful to watch. You get other very interesting young working class women who are very media literate, present themselves interesting camera angles. One of them puts a camera in her car and plays a particular piece of music as she's driving home, or has the camera in front of her while she's doing telesales. Brilliant pieces, actually. But they're not the same as this sense of a kind of a given sense of being intrinsically worthy and interesting. And I wonder if that being able to the sense of being able to accrue value, in Skeggs' sense, is also then what sets up middle class subjects for higher education. That, you know, that we've got it from the 4-year-olds who are, you know, who can do rational argument, through to 21-year-old young women who are doing very well and understand themselves to have certain value. So if that's what it takes to unproblematically enter this higher education agenda to take up higher education in at a neoliberal moment, then the working class young women's trajectories don't look like that. They don't look anything like that, actually. And so how can we understand, or what I've been trying to think about really, is how can we understand this government agenda in the light of that? Because it's no good assuming as certain government policies and certainly television programs assume that you have to do is that actually what you have to change is parenting. I mean, the endless parenting programs would suggest that you know, super nanny comes in and shows you actually that you're not doing it right and you've got to create firm boundaries and blah, 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 blah. That actually what we haven't been taking account of is the set of historical, social, cultural conditions, as I was trying to explain in the South Wales town, in which what it means to be working class makes sense, how you grow up, and therefore what it would mean to want to leave that. Because what it means to enter higher education if you're one of these government disaffected young people who lacks aspiration is that actually you might want to stay where you feel safe, where you know people, and where things make sense. What you have to want to do is to leave it. You have to want aspiration, certainly, but you've got to want something else. As some of us in this room know very well, that that involves a sense of a shift, a fantasy, for example, of being somebody. I think we can see that in the young Australian man who says he wants to be a cross between Liza Minnelli and Richard Branson. That's a fantasy of being somebody. So I think that's a different fantasy, it's different from a sense that you can present yourself to a camera as having inherent worth. It's a fantasy that you might have some worth, that you might be able to be somebody, and that you can have a life, you can have a different kind of life than the one that you've been set up for. Or the shop assistant in Sydney who says that she wants to be able to consume anything she wants, three pairs of sunglasses and two mobile phones, and that, or the running of a successful nightclub. So I just wonder if this fantasy isn't linked to a strategy to achieve, as it is in the middle class certainty of self. I mean, I haven't taken this very far, but I'm trying to think about this relationship between, on the one hand, this constant reiteration and sense that one is somebody, one can do something, one has a place, and the dream of something different, the dream of being different, and the complexities that brings. So I want to suggest then that getting into higher education for working class girls and boys requires a different strategy. So as one woman says in a documentary that I made once, a working class woman who became a social worker, she said, "I know who I have to be in that place, and I know who I have to be in that place, but I don't know who I want to be just for me." And that sense of the need to create an identity, the need to not to have a sense of not knowing where one belongs, does one belong in that place, which might be the place you grew up, but not absolutely in that place? And how do we put these things together? So aspiration can be there, but it can also be quite frightening. And I just want to give you, how am I doing for time?
You've got 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. I just want to give you one quick example of a young woman from this study who, her family was in a council house in East London, council flat rather, in East London. They bought the council flat in the right to buy, Thatcher's right to buy scheme. They sold it and they moved to Essex. Their daughter has the aspiration to be a judge. Quite really interesting aspiration. She's not done very well at school, but she's going to college. Her lecturer at college knows that she has this aspiration, but she isn't even studying law. She doesn't even seem to know what it would mean to study law, what you have to do. And in the course of the interview, it transpires that she's having sex with her much older boyfriend without contraception. And there's some discussion, both by her and her mother in the interview, about what happens if she gets pregnant. And if it happens, it happens. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it, sort of thing, her mom says. But And it's so interesting to see this juxtaposition of this ambition to be a judge and this and the kind of risky practice, sexual practice, that may result in pregnancy. And I began to think that actually, in some ways, the getting pregnant is the safer option. It's the one that will keep her at home. It's the one that her mother thinks, you know, we'll cross that bridge if we come to it. It's okay. Nobody is saying, for goodness sake, don't do it. Find a different boyfriend or, you know, make him wear condoms. No, nobody's saying that. And I actually felt that in some ways it may be a way of dealing with the difficulty, the incredible difficulty of those wanting this aspiration but being terrified of it at the same time. I mean, I don't know, I haven't got any evidence for that. That's just speculation on my part, but it seemed to me to exemplify some of the difficulties. And there's another young woman, Nikki, who says, well, you know, she's one of the three that got to university, but she didn't get there at 18 because her parents couldn't afford it. She worked in order to save up. She says, I try and help my parents a bit, I suppose. I try not to ask for too much because I know they can't afford it. But they don't like that. They don't like me knowing that they can't afford it, which is fair enough. I wanted to make sure when I went to university I had enough money. I mean, I get a £4,000, but I wanted to make sure I had enough money so I never came out of it in debt. I'm the same now. I mean, it's really tough trying to survive. So here's a young woman. She's gone and worked. She's gone and saved up in order to go and do this degree. She has to... At interview, she was very, very difficult to interview because she wouldn't open up at all about her feelings. But of course, that makes total sense. This is a young woman who has really struggled, and she's struggled to do it on her own, to not have to ask for help, to not have to be beholden to her parents. And she's also struggled with people who've laughed and said, oh God, you're still in education. You know, she's not gone and got herself a job. And so the way that I think she deals with this is to kind of keep a tight rein on herself, really, And it's that that gets her through. So what I'm trying to say is that I feel we need to know much more about how, you know, the disaffected and non-aspiring subjects are going to get, are going to take part in this widened participation, even if, of course, they have the possibility of jobs at the end of it, which is looking less likely. But let me just go back in the final couple of minutes to South Wales, because I, because the young men that we interviewed, these unemployed young men, talked about not being willing to take up available work. So these were young men who hadn't done very well at school. They'd left with no qualifications, and of course in, there is no heavy industry left in that area. That's what they want. They want heavy industry, but there isn't any. So the kind of things that are available are cleaning, supermarket work, pizza delivery, one of them does. That kind, they're very low-level service jobs, and they won't do them, or they'll try them and give up. And what transpired in a study that we did with these young men and their parents is that there's quite a lot of, I'm not sure whether this is the right word, I've called it scapegoating, I'm not sure whether this is right, but for example, a young man goes for a job as a cleaner, and the other women cleaners start calling him Mrs. Mop, and you know, make fun of him, and he gives up. Or he gets a, another young man gets a job in Domino's Pizza delivering pizzas, and he has to wear a uniform, and it turns out that his dad's friends are ridiculing the dad because his son is wearing a silly uniform, and so then the dad won't speak to the son, doesn't speak to him for a month, won't go to the pub with him, won't speak to him. But the young guy actually already has a child and needs to earn some money, and he's really caught between wanting to do right by his dad and wanting to earn money. And what we came to see really in this research was a sense that the deep pain produced by the closure of the steelworks, that I wanted to call a trauma really, a social trauma, that the way of life that I described to you earlier can't exist in the same way, and the gender division of labour on which it on which it was based has gone. So actually it's very difficult for these young men to even think about, and other people in the community, to think about aspiration. I mean, it doesn't make sense. It didn't make much sense in the community, but now it's complicated by this the intergenerational, complex intergenerational agenda. So Valerie's just told me that I need to finish. So I want to finish there by saying that what I'm trying to point to here is a more complex story about what it means to be able to open up participation to higher education for working class students.
Thank you very much, Valerie. That was terrific. Lots of food for thought and reflection. So I'd like to invite questions, comments, responses from colleagues, please. I really enjoyed your presentation, Valerie. And what I wondered is to some extent,
the culprit that governmentality theory didn't really deliver to us sufficient kind of complexity, both about the kind of ways in which discourses actually meet real lives, institutions, and so on, and that, and indeed, discourses themselves are kind of, and including neoliberalism, are deeply contradictory. So I guess, to some extent, what I'm actually saying is the partly what you're grappling with is the inability of particularly governmentality theory to kind of shed sufficient light because of the way that theoretical work kind of worked to help us understand what you've actually beautifully presented.
Maybe just following on from that, I guess it was a really interesting talk. I was a bit troubled though by the distinction between middle class and working class people on the basis of who feels they have value, because one of the things that, as I understand it, governmentality theory suggests is that middle class people clearly don't feel they have value either, which is why they kind of do all this self-help stuff. And this, you know, the idea of working on the self is suggests that the value is to be realised, but it's not in the now. It's kind of, so I just wonder if that the distinction on the basis of self worth is potentially a bit troubling to uphold, because if you're going to look at theories of subjectivity, it's kind of in relation to discourse, and it's a bit, I'm not quite sure where you can go if you're starting from the position that middle class people are kind of okay, and that therefore theories of discourse and subjectivity are really problematic mainly for working class people, who don't have a sense of value, who don't have a sense of place. About this, really just coupling that sense of certainty stuff, and I just also, I was trying to justify myself asking it, because I was just like coming out as very middle class and at the same time deeply troubled, and none of my friends coming out of university who were equally middle class had any sense of value as we left university. And I was thinking, how can I say this question without just positioning myself as I'm... But I thought that I was just really wondering of how a more complex understanding of that middle class appearance of certainty, and you did refer to it, you said it was the ability to present yourself in front of a video as having certainty rather than, might actually then also shed light onto the kinds of subjectivities that will take up offers of higher education. Sorry, that's
It was to return to the notion of governmentality and to question a little bit the idea that it meant that, you know, that whatever was produced by that was strongly determined, very strongly. I mean, I see it as something that, I mean, Foucault has a notion of eventualization, which is to do with of what happens in the moment, in a sense, but includes also the sense of the historical trajectory. So going back to the notion of the diachronic, actually, the governmentality produces subjectivities within particular moments. So there is the moment still, as well as the historical trajectory. So it was just a question, really, if not governmentality is still actually at work, but in different ways, depending on the historical trajectories of the people that are actualizing this. So that was a kind of comment query.
Asking again here. Go back to my notes. Thank you. I found that absolutely fascinating, wonderful, as ever. So many issues came up for me listening to that. The first one was in relation to the privatization, the individualization of higher education, and the classification of higher education as a positional private good, and how that's coming out in so many of the research findings on widening participation in Britain, that so many of the motivations are about the exchange value of the higher education product in the labour market. And that's very interesting in the UK. And I'm
contrasting that with the data we're analysing, Cathy and I are analysing at the moment, coming from Ghana and Tanzania, where there's a cleavage between different sorts of motivations among young people for going into higher education. And on the one hand, you've got this group of people who enact what you've described, Valerie, in terms of seeing a poverty, rural, regional deprivation as something you have to escape from. So I'm kind of coding this up as the people who are motivated by social differentiation, that they see the material and lifestyle benefits of people who've had access to higher education, and they say, I want to be like that. And they identify very much with the becoming a somebody, the Wexler's discourse. Then you've got another powerful group who talk about social responsibility, and they see higher education as something that will enable them to empower their communities. So they see it very much in terms of putting something back into the poverty. And I think we might have lost that in Britain, where it's now being seen very much as something that's instrumentalized. And also, just to add to your point about anxiety, and I made a note when you were speaking about whether anxiety is now the dominant disposition required to succeed in education, and it's maybe not class-based. There are different manifestations, different signifiers of anxiety, but it's working on people's fear of poverty, of unemployment, of being a nobody, and that works across different social groups. And just to finish the point that in research on what employers want on in new graduates, they frequently identify dispositions as well as subject knowledge. So yes, they want a 2-1, but more important, or as important, are the interpersonal communication skills and the ability to perform the neoliberal subject requirements. And again, that cuts across the different classes, and I think the young women you described, who are performing so well to camera, had decoded how, maybe had decoded how to perform those dispositions.
Thank you very much for all those questions.
Thank you.
Now, I have to see whether I can read my writing now. Well, let me take with do with the governmentality one first. That governmentality theory didn't deliver enough complexity, and that governmentality theory did assume a historical trajectory. I absolutely agree, it does. I think my, I used Foucault for a long time in my work, but actually what I feel in, I suppose, what I sometimes call sociological Foucauldianism, is a sense that you have a very clear, that's perhaps clear is not the right word, a simple relationship between this historically produced mode, discourses and practices of governance and the practices of self-regulation, self-management in which you enter. And actually that's the relationship that's looked at, and that's only the relationship. So what it lacks, it's as though subjectivity was formed out of those modes of subjectification, whereas what I've come to think more recently is that it's too simplistic, because it doesn't take account of the multiple and complex aspects of the positionings, of the histories through which particular subjectivities are founded. As long ago, well, in 1984, some of us wrote a book called Changing the Subject, where we were trying to say that subjectivity is more than the sum total of positions in discourse since birth. But I think even now I would say that even, and I try to make sense of that by saying, well, we've got to look at how the relationship between those discursive positions is lived, but I don't even think that's complicated enough.
I think that what we have to look at is experience in a complex way, and I suppose I've been trying to make sense of data which doesn't quite fit, and with these local differences and you see in the differences between the South Wales and the New South Wales data, if you like, the kinds of industrial shifts, the neoliberalisation of governments, the marketisation, the globalisation of the labour market, they're similar. But the kinds of positions taken up are different, and therefore one has to explain that difference. I mean, I might not have got it right yet, but that's what I'm trying to think about. So of course I agree that Foucault had a historical project, but I do agree that with Susan that it didn't deliver enough complexity, partly because of the way that, although it suggests that governmentality is productive of subjects, it assumes, I think, too simple a relationship in that production. I suppose that's what I was trying to say. Let's go on to this issue of value. Okay, well, I wasn't trying to say, although maybe at some level I was, but I wasn't consciously trying to say that middle-class people are okay. Although I have to admit that when there has been a strand in my writing and thinking that's certainly been filled with a kind of envy that thinks that middle-class people do indeed have it okay. Yes, I think that's certainly there. But actually, you see, I think there's a... How can we engage with this? I mean, actually, these middle-class young women seem to be possessed with chronic anxiety about their performance. So that's not okay. It's certainly not okay. I mean, really, some quite difficult stories. But at the same time, I'm trying to say that they do, that the way in which they come to take up certain positions does give them a sense of entitlement, perhaps, a sense of value is what Skates is talking about, a particular sense of embodiment, of being able to inhabit a space in a particular way, a sense of being an individual, an ability to do rational argument, all of which fit the demands of higher education. I'm not saying that people, I mean, Claudia, you said, well, you know, people like you and your friends come out of higher education and it isn't okay. Well, I'm not saying that it all is. But I am, what I was trying to do, perhaps too crudely, was to contrast these working class girls who don't display those characteristics. They don't come out with an expectation that they're going to do well. They don't have the same kind of anxiety about the performance. I'm not saying they're not anxious, but I would say that the anxiety is different. They're different kinds of anxieties, different modes of subjectivity. I think that's what I'm trying to argue, really. And that although governmentality theory assumes that middle-class people might not have intrinsic value, that they have to produce themselves, nevertheless, they have been producing themselves in that way. But it's assumed that everybody produces themselves in that way. And what I'm trying to understand is the fact that I feel that this
research that I've been doing over the years shows that not everybody does, and that we need to tell a different story, and that if we want to understand something about widening participation, we need not to assume that it's a simple matter of working class students lacking aspiration or being disaffected, which is simply a pathologization without understanding the specificities of the particular histories and trajectories. So the comparison of the working class and middle class, of course, is an artifact of the study that I was doing, but nevertheless, I feel that the sense that 14 out of 15 young women go on problematic to university at 18, and 3 out of 15 working class young women go to university, none of them at 18, is something that we have to explain, and it isn't simply explained by a neoliberal agenda which suggests that anybody can remake themselves and has to make themselves. That's all I'm trying to say, really. That the Louise's points about anxiety, fear of poverty, unemployment is not class based. Well, I'm sure that's right, but I suppose I'm concerned about the some of the young people and older people in this town in South Wales wouldn't even, you know, get on the bus. They're not even going to try, because they think that there's no point, actually. They think that they won't even move, they won't go to a town really literally down the road, because people will look after their own, they say. Therefore, it's better to stay here, and what you have to do is reorient yourself to what it means to manage to get by in this context. And you said employers want dispositions. Well, absolutely, because I think that's like the Sophia who aligned herself with having a personality to sell, that they're asking for not necessarily skills, actually, but particular kinds of personality types and psychological dispositions. But of course, if we take that historically, how are those dispositions produced, and what happens to the people who aren't displaying those dispositions?
At which point, we're just going to have to close down for lunch, but if you've got any questions you wish to pick up, there'll be space at the end of today, after Claudia's paper, when we hope to pull a few things together. And thank you once again, Valerie, for your contribution, and thank you for your questions.